On behalf of the Neil A. Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship and Religious Education and the Harold B. Lee Library, the three co-sponsors of this lecture series, I would love to welcome you now to the 12th lecture in this series and the last one, celebrating his 100th birthday. I'm Paul Hoskison from the Neil A. Maxwell Institute. You'll notice out on the table out there some of the flyers and some of the literature that we produce. I hope you also put your name on a slip of paper for a drawing for the book. If you hadn't, go ahead and slip out right now before Michael starts and put your name on a book, and we'll draw a name out, and you get the display copy of One Eternal Round this evening. It has been a real pleasure to be a part of this lecture series, and now especially to welcome Michael Rhodes as our last lecturer in this series. Michael has been a friend and a colleague for many years since he joined the faculty here at BYU. He was born in Salt Lake City, graduated from West High School, served a mission in the then South Germany mission. He also served in the Special Forces in the Army. Graduated in classics from Brigham Young University with a major in Greek and a minor in Latin and German. He also has learned Irish and a few other weird things like Egyptian. He has a Bachelor of Science degree from the Air Force Institute of Technology, is that what it's called? Good. In electrical engineering. A man of many talents. He has a master's degree also in astronomy from the University of New Mexico. He served also as an officer in the United States Air Force, rising to the rank of major. He studied Egyptology for 3 years at Johns Hopkins University under Hans Gerdeke, and also 3 years at the Freie Universität in Berlin for 3 years, Egyptology. He's also spent some time at Oxford. Before coming to BYU, he was serving in the Air Force and taught at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs before coming here. We're delighted to have Michael here on our faculty. He told me tonight he doesn't have much more time on the faculty, so if you want to take a class from him, sign up next fall. Michael, we're happy to have you here. I should introduce him formally, though, shouldn't I? I've been in the habit of doing that these last lectures. Herr Professor Dr. Rhodes. We want to welcome especially his wife here tonight.
Well, as I was mentioning to Wilfred and Paul at dinner this evening, I'm not normally used to reading a talk. I at best have an outline and go from there, but so you'll have to forgive me if I'm not quite so spontaneous as I might be. I'm frankly very envious of Wilfred being able to have given his talk on April Fool's Day. I immediately thought of the remark of Obi-Wan Kenobi when Han Solo was talking about him being a fool. He says, "Who's the greater fool, the fool or the fool who follows him?" Well, I'm following Wilfred and perhaps the greater fool. All right. I'm going to be talking about Hugh Nibley and Egyptology in the Book of Abraham. And I'd like to begin by talking about really the end when the decision was made to finally publish Hugh's One Eternal Round. February 23rd, 2005, I, along with a group of colleagues, including John Welsh, John Gee, and others, were gathered in the front room of Hugh Nibley's home. Hugh was there in a hospital bed, but he was unconscious. His wife, Phyllis, and some of their children were also present. We had met to decide what to do with Hugh's unfinished book, One Eternal Round, so aptly named. He'd been working on it for more than 15 years, but had simply become too ill to continue. A few months before, we had gone up in the upper story of his house and gathered up materials from several different rooms. This comprised over 30 boxes of papers, notes, pictures, as well as computer files to the order of about 450 that contained sometimes as many as 20 different versions of a given chapter. A huge amount of material. How could we take all this and make a book out of it? As we talked, it became clear the only practical way to do this would be for one person to simply immerse himself in this massive collection of material and condense and distill it into publishable form. This would require much more than simple editing, and the person would have to be a co-author because there were many parts that were still incomplete. As we all looked uncomfortably at each other, no one at that point was willing to commit to doing it. So we adjourned without making a final decision. The rest of that day, I almost felt like Alma says, I suffered the pangs of a damned soul. The rest of the day, it kept going over and over in my mind. Mike, you've got to do this. That night, I lay awake, still struggling with the magnitude of the task and whether I could even accomplish it. Finally, sometime in the middle of the night, a sense of calm came over me, and I realized this was something I had to do and could do. I would finish this book for Hugh. I owed him so much. All the things he had done for me over the years. I'd been working on the book with him since I first joined the faculty in 1993. By saying working on it, I was encouraging him to come up with some final form of it, and he'd give me a chapter or two that he said was final, and then two months later it wouldn't be. That's the extent of what I really did. So the next morning I called Shirley Ricks to tell her I'd be willing to do it and that I would call Phyllis, Hugh's wife, and let her know. She said that would be great. I hung up and was doing a couple of other things in my office before getting ready to call Phyllis when the phone rang. It was Shirley saying that Hugh had passed away earlier that morning. I firmly believe that once I had made that decision, Hugh somehow knew it and felt he could then leave this life assured that his book would be finished. For the next 5 years, one eternal round would dominate my life. Now, before I begin talking about Hugh Nibley and his preparation and his work in Egyptology in the Book of Abraham, I need to give somewhat of a background of my own life that I think I see the Lord of the hand guiding me to prepare me to accomplish this task. Even as a child, I was interested in languages and ancient cultures, but like Hugh, I was also drawn to the sciences, especially astronomy. In 1956, I was 9 years old, and I found a copy of The Pearl of Great Price in my parents' bookshelf. As I flipped through it, I came across the facsimiles of the Book of Abraham. I was immediately intrigued by the strange drawings and hieroglyphs, and when I read through the explanation to facsimile 2 and came to the statement, if the world can find out these numbers, so let it be. It was a moment of epiphany. I felt a burning desire to learn Egyptian so I could read those characters. I immediately went down to the public library, approached one of the librarians, and told her I wanted a book on Egyptian hieroglyphs. I'm sure she thought I was crazy. The jury is still out on that one. But she looked in the catalog and found a book for me that I could check out. Thus began my lifelong interest in study of Egyptology. In 1967, when I was on my mission in Germany, the electrifying news came of the discovery of the, I guess we should better say rediscovery of the Joseph Smith papyri, photos of which were published in the February 1968 Ensign. In February 1968, I just returned from my mission in southern Germany and enrolled at BYU, where I began working on a degree in classical Greek. I took a couple of classes in biblical Hebrew, but my real desire was to study Egyptian. I mentioned to one of the classic graduate students that I was thinking of asking Hugh Nibley to teach a class in Middle Egyptian. I'd never met him, but I had read some of the things that he had written. He said, "Don't bother." I tried to get him to do it the year before, and he didn't want to do it. Nevertheless, I screwed up my courage and went to his office over in the old Joseph Smith building, knocked on the door. He invited me in, and I explained I was interested in doing graduate work in Egyptology and asked if he would be willing to teach a class in Middle Egyptian. Well, it was astounding. He became very enthusiastic about it. He says, "Come with me." Drug me up to the office of the Dean of Religion to get permission to schedule a class. Then he hauled me over to the administration building, and we got the class scheduled. Just like that, within 2 hours, we had a class in Middle Egyptian. I was able to then take a couple of semesters of Middle Egyptian from him before I graduated and went on to graduate school at Johns Hopkins the following year. Well, 1970, I began to study Egyptology at Johns Hopkins under Professor Hans Gutecke. Initially, it was an exhilarating time. I was, you know, like a kid in a candy store, and the owner gone somewhere. It was a wonderful time. In the summer of 1972, I accompanied Gutecke on an archaeological dig in Giza, Egypt. Right there, I could throw a rock. I didn't, but I could throw a rock and hit the Sphinx. We were right there at the foot of the pyramids, and the Sphinx was right next to us. While there at Hopkins, Hugh and I corresponded occasionally, and he encouraged me in my studies. But as time progressed, it became increasingly clear that Gutecke was dissatisfied with my point of view. For me, Egyptology was a means of understanding the Book of Abraham and Joseph Smith, and on several occasions I would go to him and I'd say, "Look at this, Joseph Smith said this, and it's right," and his response was always, "Lucky guess." After I'd been at Hopkins for 3 years, he called me into his office and told me he felt that I could not be a good Egyptologist because, as a Mormon, I could not be objective about things Egyptian. I wrote to Hugh explaining the situation. He wrote back. This is a quote from a letter he sent me. "Gutecke's obvious annoyance at your independence is the best guarantee that you're really going to produce something." He goes on to say, "I have never been objective, quotation marks, and never will be. Don't weaken. You may be the world's last, as I am the world's worst scholar." So in the spring of 1973, I left Johns Hopkins and returned to Utah. I now had two children and no job. There weren't a lot of people clamoring for someone with a degree in classical Greek at that time. After pursuing various job options, I finally decided to enlist in the United States Air Force. Prior to my mission, I had spent time in the, as Paul mentioned, in the Army, 19th Special Forces National Guard unit down at the point of the mountain. Not the same thing as, although sometimes it felt like prison. I spent the next 20 years in the Air Force. The first 5 years I was enlisted working as a German and Russian linguist, and the remaining 15 years as an officer, first working in intelligence. Remember, military intelligence is an oxymoron, and then as a computer engineer. Although it seemed that my dream of being an Egyptologist would not be, I continued to pursue an education wherever I was stationed. The programs I enrolled in mirrored my divided interests in science and the ancient world. I studied physics at the University of Utah, physics and electrical engineering at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, Egyptian, Demotic, Hebrew, and Greek at the Freie Universität Berlin. Hugh would roll over in his grave with this one. Business administration through the University of Colorado at Boulder. That didn't last long. It was like eating dry sawdust. It was awful. an electrical engineering degree at Utah State University, archaeology at the University of Utah again. This was another time when I was in Utah. I was able to spend a summer on an archaeological dig in Petra at that time. However, before I could complete any of these programs, the Air Force would transfer for me to a new duty station and I'd have to start over again. During this frustrating period, I did manage to publish one article on facsimile number 2, where I did a translation and commentary of facsimile number 2, something that I wanted to do clear back, you recall, in fourth grade. I continued to correspond with Nibley, and he always encouraged me not to give up, but to keep at it. For example, when I was in Berlin, studying Egyptology there in Berlin, 3 cheers, he says. The path of genius is a rough one, and I glory in my safe mediocrity. Typical Nibley, isn't it? I'm more convinced than ever that certain Egyptian texts are still trying to get through to us, now specifically to you. And then he referred to his recent work on the Book of Enoch, and this falls in line with what Wilfred was talking about last week. What terrible risks I take at being thought a fool, and how little it bothers me. Finally, in September 1980, I began a program in electrical engineering at the Air Force Institute of Technology at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. And because the Air Force was sponsoring that, I finally got to graduate, and I graduated with a second bachelor's degree in electrical engineering. And while I enjoyed working as an engineer, my true love was still Egypt. In 1985, I was transferred to Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Soon after I got there, I went over to the University of Mexico, New Mexico, like I usually do, to see what kind of graduate programs they had. The only archaeology they had was American Indian archaeology, which did not interest me, so I went over to the physics department. Next thing I knew, I was enrolled in a physics program with a major in astronomy. When I wrote Hugh about that, he responded, "You're doing the right thing." And I often have brief pangs of regret that I reversed course long ago. But when I went on a mission, I discovered that people were really suffering more from their weird ideas about the human past than about the nature of the universe. So after my mission, I took to the stacks. While working on that physics degree in New Mexico, I applied to teach at the United States Air Force Academy and was accepted. And upon completion of my degree in the spring of 1989, I was transferred to the Academy where I taught physics and astronomy and was director of the Academy Observatory. I'd now been in the Air Force 17 years and would be eligible to retire in 3 more. I wrote to Hugh and indicated that I had hopes of coming to BYU to teach. While I found astronomy interesting, my first love was still Egyptian, after my wife. And I hoped to be able to do research and teach in that area. His response was, to say the least, encouraging. "I'm absolutely elated that you are still a follower of Thoth." Thoth is the god of wisdom in Egypt. I was zerknirscht. Désolé, he throws every different language back and forth in there, crushed and desolated, I guess, in French there, German the other. "When I heard that you had gone into what I have always considered would be heaven to study," a beautiful pun there as well, astronomy heaven. "I started out that way when I was most emphatically directed into the neglected archives, and I thought naturally that since you had taken the opposite direction, you were the lucky one. I'm teaching only one class, and I got down to reading everything we have here in Egyptian. I soon discovered that this stuff is by no means as trivial as people have thought, and it has turned out to be vastly rewarding. It is because of the constant occurrence of motifs, themes, and images which should be hauntingly familiar to anyone who has lived with our LDS mystique. The only dark cloud on my enterprise has been the depressing thought that Mike Rhodes would not be able to take over." No one could take over for Hugh Nibley. "Naturally, I thought you were committed forever to the hermetism of Newton and the mysticism of Flammarion," an early astronomer, and would never think of returning to the dusty sands. You can imagine how elated I am at the news that I was quite wrong. I'm absolutely convinced that your great work will be in that subject, which so fascinated and inspired the prophet Joseph. I can hardly contain myself for joy. Your timing is good, though you may think me terribly optimistic to think I'm good for another 3 years. He lasted much longer than that, as we know. In any other calling, 80 would be the time to retire, but I have never found the Lord's work to be anything but exhilarating and rejuvenating. I will try to hang on until you get here, but you must come. And then he has a little... this was typed by his secretary, and then he has a little handwritten note there. How dubitandum, without a doubt in Latin, your path will be prepared in the wilderness. That was a prophetic statement. It really was. So in 1993, I retired from the Air Force and moved to Provo, and with the help from both Nibley and from Wilfred Griggs as well, I began teaching part-time in the Department of Ancient Scripture. I had the opportunity of spending a summer studying Egyptology at Oxford, and then in 1995, I was given a full-time position as an associate research professor and have been here ever since. During the 17 years I've been on the faculty, I've been able to publish translation commentaries of the Joseph Smith Papyri, a commentary on the Pearl of Great Price, and several articles in response to criticisms on the Book of Abraham, as well as articles on astronomy and the creation of the Book of Abraham. I've traveled a rather roundabout road, but in retrospect, I think I see the Lord's hand in it. And moreover, I believe that it prepared me to tackle this formidable task of finishing one eternal round. Let's turn now to Hugh Nibley in the Book of Abraham. For many members and non-members of the church, Hugh Nibley is best known for his work on the Book of Abraham and the Joseph Smith Papyri. And yet a historian trained in classics is not an obvious candidate for dealing with things Egyptian. How was it that he could so ably handle these topics when the church acquired the papyri fragments in 1967? It's clear that the Lord had been preparing Hugh for this role. While still in graduate school at Berkeley, he had begun to teach himself Egyptian from Alan Gardner's Egyptian Grammar, and he made use of Egyptian in his dissertation and in several articles that he published in the 1940s and 50s. In 1946, after the end of World War II, Nibley joined the faculty at BYU. After examining the contents of the library, he reported, "I found on the shelves just one Greek book, Homer, and one Latin book, Manilius, and I soon found that nobody in Provo could read a line of either one." Thanks in no small part to Hugh Nibley, the library at BYU now contains a large and varied collection of books on the ancient world. The ancient studies room in the library, which contains both Latin and Greek patrologii, the Egyptian collection of Samuel Mercer, as well as many other reference works on the ancient world, is fittingly named after him. Also under his influence, programs in a variety of areas dealing with the ancient world are now available at BYU, staffed by faculty well-trained in their disciplines. I think it's safe to say that Nibley's greatest accomplishment has been to motivate generations of Latter-day Saints students to become truly competent scholars to the lasting benefit of the church. His writings have asked penetrating questions and pointed the way for research in an astonishing number of areas. Some years after arriving at BYU, while doing research in the library, Hugh received a prompting that he should go back to Berkeley and study Egyptian. He applied for a sabbatical and spent the 1959-60 academic year at Berkeley. Providentially, Klaus Baer, who had just recently received his PhD in Egyptology from the University of Chicago, joined the faculty that year. Nibley studied both Egyptian and Coptic with him. Nibley's description of the experience is humorous. "I was badgered and bullied 6 hours a week by a fellow 20 years my junior, who was trying to knock the simple elements of Egyptian and Coptic into my head. It was all very elementary, my teacher would say after he had given a particularly brilliant demonstration that any Egyptian child of 10 would probably laugh himself sick at our solemn and laborious attempts to reconstruct the language. After Nedley returned from the sabbatical at Berkeley, he used Coptic in some of his articles on early Christianity, but continued to wonder what good the Egyptian would be. Still, he kept at it. In a letter to Klaus Baird in March of 1963, he remarked that he was still plugging away at the coffin text, opsit omen, knock on wood, I guess is probably a good translation of that, and finding them more diverting and far more edifying than crosswords or Agatha Christie. Over the next couple of years, he continued his reading of the coffin text, and in 1965, Klaus Baer, moved from Berkeley to the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago. And in 1966 and 67, Nibley spent another sabbatical year there studying under Baer, John A. Wilson, and George Hughes, three Egyptologists there at the Institute. On one occasion, he dropped by the office of one of the professors and saw a photograph of the original facsimile number 1 lying on the desk. Again, this is 1966-67. This is right at that period when the negotiations began for obtaining them. Now, he knew for certain that the papyri existed, although he didn't know their location, extent, or contents. He immediately began preparing himself in earnest. In the following year, he again wrote to Klaus Baer. Well, of course, I had anticipated something like it and saw that everything would pivot around the Book of the Dead, so I started reading the same a year ago, getting through the Nishonsu version, just when the Metropolitan Museum of Art scraps turned up. And it was a good thing, since, as you know, it turned out to be just more of the same. On the 27th of November 1967, the Metropolitan Museum of Art formally gave the Joseph Smith papyri fragments to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the church then published photos of the papyri in the February 1968 Improvement Era. This was a remarkable feat, since at that time it took 2 full months to publish talks from General Conference, which we now can get online the next day. Nibley was then given access to the papyri, and he began an in-depth study of them. Nibley's work on the Joseph Smith papyri and the Book of Abraham covered more than 40 years and resulted in 4 books and numerous articles and talks. His work can be divided into 4 phases, which I will deal with each in turn. Phase 1, 1968 to 71, preliminary studies. Nibley said of his initial publications during this period, "Not yet confident in Egyptian, I frankly skirmished and sparred for time, making the most of those sources which supported the Book of Abraham from another side, the recent and growing ancient and modern and forgotten legends and traditions of Abraham. They match the Joseph Smith version very closely." For example, in one of his early articles called Phase 1, he said, "So far, no one has asked how Joseph Smith came to produce a history of Abraham, which can be matched at every point from a wealth of ancient sources, Jewish and Christian apocrypha, Talmud, Mishnah, and even Gnostic, Hasidic, Kabbalistic writings, Muslim commentators, sectaries of the desert, such as the Mandeans and the Qumran people, and even the church fathers and classical writers." This is a theme which Nibley then took up again and again, elaborated in both his book Abraham and Egypt, and in its fullest extent in One Eternal Round. Nibley used the rediscovery of the papyri as an opportunity to encourage the saints to take education more seriously. He wrote, "A few faded and tattered little scripts of papyrus may serve to remind the Latter-day Saints of how sadly they have neglected serious education." He also criticized the flawed arguments of the critics of the Book of Abraham. The whole attack against the Book of Abraham in the past has been based on the perfectly false principle that whatever a prophet does must be of supernatural nature, and whatever he says must have the authority of Scripture, and that hence, if a prophet ever betrays the slightest sign of human weakness or any mortal limitation, he must necessarily be a false prophet. This silly doctrine is a projection of the deeply rooted sectarian belief that since the Bible is inspired by God, there cannot conceivably, under any circumstances whatever, be the slightest suspicion of a flaw or an inaccuracy in its pages. In other words, whatever God has anything to do with must necessarily be absolutely perfect. We know Joseph Smith himself said, a prophet is only a prophet when he's speaking as a prophet. Nidley's major publication during this period was the series of articles titled A New Look at the Pearl of Great Price, which was published in the Improvement Era between January 1968 and May 1970. In these articles, he began with a scathing criticism of the 1912 attack on the Book of Abraham by Reverend F.S. Spaulding and his panel of experts. Then he turned to facsimile number one, marshaling a wealth of evidence supporting Joseph Smith's explanation of it. Finally, he examined various ancient documents and traditions associated with Abraham that corroborated the story found in the Book of Abraham. Now, some of Nibley's conclusions in these articles are dated. For example, his treatment of the attempted sacrifice of Abraham, he compares with the ritual human sacrifice which many Egyptologists of the 1960s thought was practiced in the Sed festival. It was a festival of renewal that the king participated in. However, this view was shown to be wrong in the 1974 study of the Sed festival by Eric Hornung and Elizabeth Stalen, in which they found no evidence of human sacrifice associated with that festival. Nibley is using the best evidence available at the time, but it was later superseded by better studies. Nibley, on one occasion, made a remark to the effect that I'm not responsible for anything I said over 2 years ago, because things change. He was, you know, right up with the current things, but things have changed since then. Nevertheless, Nibley raised many important points and advanced many insightful arguments that would be crucial to further work on the Joseph Smith papyri in the Book of Abraham. I leaned heavily on what he did in my own work in this area. As Klaus Baer remarked in a letter to one of Nibley's critics, Nibley should not be underestimated. He is not a fully trained Egyptologist, but he knows a great deal in a great many fields, writes well, and is a skilled debater. His articles in the Improvement Era hit very close to home if you know something about the field. It is unfortunately true that Egyptologists have behaved like pompous asses with a claim to infallibility, that they have restricted themselves to ill-considered snap judgments in dealing with the Mormons that they never would have ventured to produce if there had been a risk of critical examination by their colleagues, evaded problems, and insisted that the layman accept their opinions without question. Phase 2, 1971 to 1976. During this period, Nibley's research focused on the Joseph Smith papyri, and specifically on the papyri fragments 1, 10, and 11. Joseph Smith papyri 10 and 11 contained part of what was called the Book of Breathings, and Joseph Smith papyri 1 was the original facsimile number 1, and it formed the beginning vignette or illustration of that text. Nibley was the first to recognize that these three papyri were not part of the Book of the Dead. The Metropolitan Museum of Art thought all of the papyri that they turned over to the church were Book of the Dead papyri. Klaus Baer noted this later. He said, let's face it, it was Nibley and not the Egyptologist who noticed that the Sen-Sen, that's another term for the Book of Breathings, the Sen-Sen fragments were not from the Book of the Dead. His work on the Book of Breathing text is contained in his book, The Message of the Joseph Smith Papyri, An Egyptian Endowment, a very catchy title for Mormons. and this was published in 1975. The second edition became volume 16 in the collected works of Hugh Nibley and was published in 2005. Nibley correctly identified the Book of Breathings as an initiatory text and saw in it many parallels with Latter-day Saint temple ceremony. In his introduction, he wrote, "Latter-day Saints believe that their temple ordinances are as old as the human race and represent a primordial revealed religion that has passed through alternate phases of apostasy and restoration, which have left the world littered with the scattered fragments of the original structure, some more and some less recognizable, but all badly damaged and out of proper context. But what about the Egyptian rites? What are they to us? They are a parody, an imitation, but as such, not to be despised. For all the great age and consistency of their rites and teachings, which certainly commanded respects, the Egyptians did not have the real thing, and they knew it. They were, as I.E.S. Edwards puts it, like a people searching in the dark for a key to the truth, and having found not one but many keys, retaining all, lest perchance the appropriate one should be discarded. If the Egyptian endowment was but an imitation, it was still a good one, and we may be able to learn much from it. But it is not for a moment to be equated with the true and celestial order of things." He closes his introduction with this delightfully Nibley-esque statement, "Actually, the documentation of the book is minimal, our purpose being not to prove a case, but to state one, confining comments to well-known themes and confirming plausibility from the most readily available sources and study. Minimal. There's 3,475 footnotes citing over 700 separate books and articles, as well as six large appendixes." That's minimal from Nibley's point of view. For the rest of us, it's overkill, to say the least. In dealing with the Book of Breathing, since Joseph Smith's copy is badly damaged and missing significant portions of the text, Nibley turned to the well-preserved and complete Louvre papyrus N3284, and he used this for a full translation and commentary of the text. A look at the titles of the chapters give a good overview of what he covers. And again, as he mentions in his introduction, those who've been through the temple, will, you know, this will resonate, but he said, I will say nothing about that. You just have to see it for yourself as you read through it. The nature and purpose of the Book of Breathings, initiation rites, entering the temple, the creation, resurrection of man, the garden story, the long road back, the fearful passage, culmination and conclusion. In the introductory note to the appendixes, in the appendixes, Hugh included various non-Egyptian documents that had the same motif and theme. And in that introduction, he says, "As in a hall of mirrors," temple imagery again, "the Book of Breathing seems to be reflected in an endless procession of documents that fade out of sight in either direction. Behind it lie the Egyptian funerary and temple texts that go back to the beginning, and after it come an equally impressive succession of early Christian and Jewish writings that move on down through the patristic literature to our own day." Supporting material in the appendices include materials from the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Odes of Solomon, the Pearl, Pistis Sophia, Cyril of Jerusalem's lecture on the ordinances, and the Gospel of Philemon's. Philip. One of my favorite statements in this book is Nibley's answer to those who question the relevancy of studying ancient Egypt. "But granted its mind-expanding scope, is the Egyptian experience at all relevant to the modern world? The answer is no. And neither is Mormonism relevant to the distracted modern world, which has no concern with the things of eternity and will soon be forgotten." Nibley always maintained that eternal perspective. As with Nibley's previous series of articles in the Improvement Era, there are recent advances in our knowledge of ancient Egypt that modify some of his conclusions in Message. When this book came out, only a few Egyptian religious texts from the Greco-Roman period had been published, and now there are more than 1,000. As Professor John Gee remarked in his introduction to the second edition of this book, in all of this, Nibley was asking the right questions and answering both to the best of his ability and to the best of anyone's ability at the time. Although we can provide better answers now, Nibley did a respectable job at the time. Nibley's period piece remains a treasure trove of useful information and insights. Two important things that Nibley got right are, first, that the Book of Breathings was an initiation text. At the time, there were only a few Egyptologists, kind of at the fringe, who thought that initiation existed in ancient Egypt, but is now generally accepted by most people in the discipline. This goes hand in hand with Nibley's realization that the so-called Egyptian funerary texts are not necessarily funerary, but were also used by the living. This, too, is now part of mainstream Egyptology. Phase 3, 1979 to 81. Nibley's major publication in this period was Abraham in Egypt. As he states in the introduction, the purpose of the present book is to carry forward the beginning made in my long series of articles in the Improvement Era and a book on the Egyptian endowments, and in the process to clarify the proposition that the critics up to now have been exceeding their authority in maintaining that the Book of Abraham cannot, by the remotest possibility, have anything to do with the real Abraham or the real Egypt. In Abraham in Egypt, Nibley brings together evidence from numerous ancient sources, apocryphal, pseudepigraphal, Egyptian, Jewish, early Christian, Islamic, that demonstrate that the Book of Abraham contains many things about Abraham not found in the Old Testament, but which do turn up in these ancient sources. Since the publication of this book, other Latter-day Saint scholars have continued to do research in this area. One of the more notable publications is John Twetness, Brian Haugliz, and John Gee's Traditions About the Early Life of Abraham, a very ponderous tome that contains reams of references to Abraham, traditions about Abraham that match what we find in the Book of Abraham but are not found in the Bible. As he says, but Nibley goes beyond just demonstrating the reliability of the Book of Abraham's information. He gets to the root of what the real importance of the Book of Abraham is. He says in the concluding chapter of this book, granted, Joseph Smith has turned out an impressive performance, but what good is it to us? What has the Book of Abraham to teach the modern world in general and the church in particular? That is, of course, the message of Abraham, for we are commanded to do the works of Abraham, referring to D&C section 132, verse 32, and we are told that there is no other way for us to go. Only by doing the works of Abraham can we hope to establish a better order of things on the earth, that order of Zion lost since the days of Noah. This takes courage, tact, unfailing faith, and the constant aid of divine revelation. It entails more than human contrivance or human wisdom. Abraham must acquire ever more and more knowledge. The guiding principle is intelligence and awareness of things as they are, the physical world, the structure and nature of the cosmos, and the spiritual realities that are behind everything. For Abraham, everything is a prelude to what lies beyond. To Nibley, the real value of the Book of Abraham is the eternal truths it teaches us. That brings us now to Phase 4, the 1990s, and One Eternal Round. For the remainder of his life, Nibley worked on what was to be his magnum opus and his swan song. One Eternal Round is the culmination of a lifetime of his thoughts and research on the Book of Abraham, especially facsimile number 2. The volume is impressive in its penetrating insights into and coverage of the subject. Within its scope, NBV deals with mathematics and geometry as they relate to the hypocephalus, Alexander the Great, the Egyptian pharaohs Sheshonq and Sesostris, medieval Jewish Kabbalah, medieval Jewish and Islamic traditions about about Abraham, ancient Hermeticism, Greek myths and their relationship with Egyptian and Mesopotamian myths, early Jewish and Christian apocrypha, ancient Chinese jade disks, Indian mandalas, the Aztec calendar, shaman drums, ancient Egyptian mirrors, axial times, the great year rites of ancient civilization, Paleolithic cave drawings in France, the Tabula Smaragdina, Hopi Indian ceremonies, alchemy, the relationship of myth, ritual, and history. All these are woven together in a magnificent tapestry of compelling evidence demonstrating that the Book of Abraham and its facsimiles represent actual ancient materials and traditions that have all come to light long after Joseph Smith published them. As I sifted through the enormous mountain of material that comprised Nibley's work on One Eternal Round, my chief goal was to remain true to Hugh's purpose. I wanted to present his research and arguments as clearly as possible. This required reconciling the many versions of his chapters and writing transitions between various sections, as well as clarifying some of his arguments on the basis of the sources cited. However, in all that I did, uppermost in my mind was the thought that this was Hugh's book, not mine. And I made every effort to keep my editing and writing at a minimum. At least in the opinion of one recent reviewer, I seem to have succeeded. As Paul quoted him last time, 5 years saw the process of publication through, and so many editorial decisions had to be made that Rhodes is listed as the co-author of the book. Even so, relatively little of it seems to be Rhodes' actual writing. Nibley's voice is unmistakable throughout the book. I'm elated to hear that. It is my sincerest hope that when it comes my turn to cross through the veil, that Hugh will approach me with that beautiful smile on his face and words of approval for what I have done. He was a true friend, a mentor, and an inspiration to all the scholarly work that I have done. Without his help and influence, I never would have accomplished what I have. Working on this book of his has been for me a labor of love. I know he wanted so much for it to be published, and I hope he is pleased with it. To paraphrase Mormon, and now if there are faults in this book, they are the faults of Mike. Therefore, condemn not the things of Hugh Nibley. Thank you.